Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, and welcome to this Sydney Writers Festival Curiosity Lecture. My name is Sally Coleman. I'm a musician, a writer, and a radio presenter who most recently was the host of Triple J Breakfast. And I'm really excited to welcome you to this talk by Bernard Collaery on rescuing. Now, before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that the land we are on today belongs to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And I pay my respects to Gadigal elders past, present, and emerging. I'd also like to recognise the ongoing relationship between Gadigal people and country. We're about to hear from Bernard Collaery. Now, Bernard has been a fearless advocate for human rights throughout his career as a solicitor, barrister, and politician. In 2018, he was charged for allegedly conspiring to breach the Intelligence Services Act 2001, along with someone called Witness K. He was forbidden from speaking about the charges against him, but in 2013, during East Timor's case at The Hague, it was revealed that the Australian Secret Intelligence Service had been bugging the East Timorese government during negotiations over Timor Sea oil, and it was a huge political scandal. Bernard's book, Oil Under Troubled Water, explores the backstory of Australia's government dealings with our neighbour East Timor, which is one of the poorest nations in the world. But in his talk today, Bernard's going to be focusing on something a little bit different. He's going to be talking about the international politics of a rescue. Because if you found yourself in dire straits, whether or not you get rescued might depend on where you are in the world. It's this really strange situation where the obligation to provide assistance to someone else can vary really dramatically, even between places like the EU and the UK. So where does Australia sit on this weird legal scale of saving people? Bernard Collaery is here to tell us. Please make him feel welcome.
Thank you, Sally. Well, actually, I couldn't speak on the real topic if I wanted to. I'm forbidden from. Now, I'm delighted to be here. I welcome you being here because some of you have made, I know, quite a trip, so thank you very much. It's privileged and humbling to speak to you. Now, rescue. One issue that I mentioned to Sally a moment ago is that I acted in the Threadbow landslide issue, the Blue Mountains rail disaster, aircraft crashes, a fire aboard a Royal Australian Navy tanker in Western Australia some years ago, and a whole variety of rescue issues. And so I can look back across meeting very brave rescuers, extraordinary, interesting people, ordinary people who've gone above any sense of duty, because I'm going to tell you there's no duty. But I was disarmed once. I said to a witness, "You were very quick to jump off that wharf to rescue that child that had fallen off the wharf into the water." I said, "You even beat his father." He said, "Yeah, I'd had too many coffees." So it's a very interesting and challenging topic. But I want to also go back quickly in the time permitted to what the festival, Michael Williams, the festival director, and the opening speakers at this festival spoke of, which is the way our country is moving towards a sense of personal responsibility. That is, it's easy for me to typify that by saying our personal responsibility not to burn plastic in our back garden, the personal responsibility of the environment, for instance. And that is the more, that is the move that might be particularly coming over our country in the current political environment, whereas Professor Grayling says quite firmly in his book, which is on sale here, I see, Democracy, Professor Grayling says that we've moved to not government for the people, by the people, where the people are the sovereign people and we reflect our wishes through our representatives, but we've moved towards, as Professor Grayling says, an elective dictatorship who issue laws and rules. Now, we must rue the day that we passed a law saying that we could trial terrorists in secret. We could trial them without telling them the full evidence, and we could trial them without telling the jury the full evidence. We should rue the day we passed that law, because the very first person to be subjected to that law is myself. And that is shameful. And so what is and how did we come to that way? Well, the duty to rescue, the so-called duty to rescue, illustrates that path. The common law developed over the centuries in Britain, and the common law sought not to reflect the theological concept of moral and ethical duty. It sought to delineate the duties that the state thought we should hold. And therefore, the situation in the common law is, as a barrister, a colleague of mine once said, rather grimly, I thought, during the Canberra bushfire case, and my colleague John McConachie, an extraordinary Rumpolish barrister, he won't mind me saying that, his nickname's the Royal Barge. John said to the judge, who happened to have been my former opponent across the parliament, Your Honour, were I to walk down to Lake Burley Griffin at lunchtime today with Mr. Kaleri, and should he fall in, I perchance would not be obliged to rescue him. And the judge grimly remarked that even he might, but that is the common law. No one is obliged outside of the Northern Territory, where there's a specific law, section 155, that does oblige a rescuer capable of doing it without significant harm to rescue that person. The Northern Territory law reflects the civil code standard in Europe. For example, in the German penal code, you must rescue a person in peril, in imminent peril, if there is no substantial risk to yourself and the means are available to do it. In the code Nouveau Pénal in France, it is slightly different. It's without risk to him or herself, providing they have the capacity to do it. That is an extraordinary declension between our society and the European-based laws, which have spread, as I learnt in Cambridge. I gave summer lectures on this topic in Cambridge a few years ago. And the civil lawyers, as we call them, in Europe, in Brazil, in Turkey, in Greece, in mainstream Europe, in Russia, indeed, were astounded at our common law idea that it is the judges, it is the law, it is the state that is prescriptive of our duties. So that's a departure away from the ethical, moral, almost Judeo-Christian, well, it's not, holy sense of a moral duty to rescue someone in peril. Now, that is very apparent in our society. I'll give you an example. How remote should your perception be about someone in peril? The clearest example might be an overladen refugee boat that's seen on a calm sea, unaware, but potential rescuers are aware, of a storm forecast. Is the duty to rescue then and there, duty to warn as well, or is there only a duty arising when the vessel is in imminent peril during the storm? They are questions that we've been unable to find a coherent answer to in our society, but it's a question that has a very clear moral answer in other societies. Hence, the rescuing constantly, certainly unhappily in many respects, by the civil code countries in the Mediterranean at the moment, different from us. And there are other ethical dimensions. For example, at the cliff edge, how does the duty arise when the person in peril at the cliff is a skilled professional rock climber in difficulty, or a foolhardy, intoxicated cliff climber, or, for example, sadly, a person contemplating suicide? Where are the moral imperatives, if any, in respect of that? Now, all of those issues have a reality, in fact, in cases that our colleagues, legal colleagues, deal with occasionally, tragically, at inquests. The law may be different for rescuers who are on a salary, such as the fire service, but I'm not going into legal nuances in this talk. What I want to exemplify is, given our current society, given the difficulty we have as citizens of influencing political movements and decision-making by the executive in our government, what is available and how do we confront that sense of powerlessness that many of us feel with our state of government and the what we call the morality of the parliament? Now, Witness K, just notionally, of course, where does the moral imperative arise? Is it when you see one in seven infants dying before they're five in East Timor? Is it, do we wait for that to get worse? Or do we try not to, do we try to get a stable, a properly funded government in place? I'm going back 15, 16 years, of course. Now, how moral would it be to try to further impoverish or to hinder the wealth of a country emerging from a terrible catastrophe, which East Timor was in 2000? And so what about this doctrine of necessity? How necessary is it to come forward if you could advance the welfare, particularly of a circumstance easily identifiable where there is an oppressively high infant mortality rate directly related to the impoverished nature of a country? Should I come forward and say, look, I know how we could better their lot? Now, I can't go any further legally on that, but I hope you understand that nuance affecting a very, very courageous person in Australia. There'll be some lawyers in the audience, but what we've been interested in our negligence cases, I'll be very, very quick on this, is the way a sense of duty, a duty of care, has arisen and developed in the common law as we sought to give perceptions of where a duty lies and where a duty doesn't lie. The law remains that you are not obliged to rescue your fellow citizen, full stop, except unless you're in the fire brigade, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there were two eminent Roman Catholic judges on the High Court at one time. One was Sir Gerald Brennan, the other was Sir Bill Dean, before they were knights, of course. And they were men of great eminence and moral and ethical standards. But Gerald Brennan, in many respects, looked and searched for duty and the proximity between those in peril and the potential rescuer. There was a famous line from Bill Dean, and I want to read it, because from an ethical perspective, he's long since left the bench, Sir William, but it's a lament. And it's a lament good to today, and I'd like to read his words. The common law has not embraced the embarrassing moral perception that he who has failed to feed the man dying from hunger has truly killed him. They're the words of a High Court judge in a famous case. So at what level is there a moral duty? Now, for Witness K, and with his in sentence, as he intends to plead guilty, I understand. For witness K, that lament that Sir William Dean uses is so apposite, and it will reflect this country's Dreyfus moment, in my view. It will reflect the shame that should have arisen over the trial of Lindy Chamberlain, and it will reflect, when this good man is sentenced, it will reflect the state of our departure from standards of personal responsibility. Now, the common law evolved by perceptions of duty without reference to an overall moral dynamic. And that's how we're perceived in other jurisdictions. That's how we're perceived, particularly in Buddhist Asia and Hindu Asia. We're not seen to be true Samaritans. Contrary to that overriding Christian ethic in this country. Now, all of my words in no way detract from all those incredibly brave rescuers who come forward instinctively and impulsively. Now, in the time available, I can't go to Jean-Paul Sartre and Derrida and all the rest who in their writings pushed, and Derrida pushed, the concept of the basis of our society should be personal responsibility. If we are personally responsible, the environment might be saved. And that was the theme, I think, in the opening speeches of this festival. But today, in a oblique manner, bearing in mind the official secrets legislation that inhibits my words, I'm trying to get a message over that explains at least the position of witness K, a very good, decent, veteran Australian of conscience, with a personal moral responsibility for which he will be sentenced. It is shameful. Now, the other issue of necessity brings in a sense of history that is something that will develop. The lawyers here know that the famous case of necessity arose in the 18th century when, cast adrift for weeks and weeks at sea, the men in the lifeboat killed and ate the cabin boy. They were tried for murder and acquitted on grounds of necessity. And that event started to shape the common law on duty and necessity. And I think it troubles theologians, it troubles philosophy that you could do that. You could do that and defend the position. Years ago, I defended a man who had been told by his eldest son that his younger son was down the road in Queanbeyan about to shoot up. He decided he wanted to try the heroin, and he was down at a man's house, and he was about to shoot up. So Dad grabbed a cricket bat and raced down to the house, smashed the door down, and dragged his son out, young boy out. And he was charged with home invasion, etc. We ran a necessity. That's the only time I think I've run a necessity case in my career. It was necessary because we have a duty to protect an infant, a parental duty. Ambulances take more than 8 minutes in Queanbeyan at that time to reach anywhere, and you could die quicker than 8 minutes. And so, in fact, after we outlined the case, the Director of Public Prosecutions withdrew the case. That's necessity. But do we really act by necessity? Why should it be necessary? shouldn't our instinctive impulse, if we know we're capable of doing it without foolhardiness, should we not rescue? Now, when it was realised that the robo-debt, you're all familiar with the robo-debt scandal, that is, people who'd been receiving Centrelink benefits were identified as judgment debtors in effect by algorithm, by computer. They were judged, convicted, and sent the bills for overpayments based on algorithms. Now, that went on and on and on, despite the revelation of that. Now, to what extent does responsibility or necessity arise to prevent those people who were psychologically harmed in respect of that? There were allegedly many, many people who suffered severe damage and who took their own lives. Now, there's been no action in this country. And that typifies the common law. That is, they're not responsible. You can't trace it back to the person responsible. For years and years, the corporate world sought to take the concept of contribution out of the Coroner's Act throughout our country. Contribution meant you could go to the tragedy and work out each and every factor that contributed to the disaster. I'll give you an example. The lights go green at once, and there's a fatal collision. And it's found that during the software designed for the traffic light system, a public servant directed by a minister took out the fail-safe mechanism because it would cost $50,000 for each intersection. That would be contribution. Slowly across Australia in the 90s, contribution was taken out of the remit of our coroners, and you could not go back to source, as it were. The mining companies didn't want it, and after a while, many of the inquests related to state health disasters in state hospitals, and so the health departments didn't want contribution. So contribution came out, and it's out to this day everywhere. I wouldn't let it go out of the ACT when I was Attorney General, but I was pressured to do it, but I think my successor took it out. Now, so we need to get back to notions, philosophical, ethical notions of responsibility in our country, because responsibility is rarely sheeted home except in scapegoating cases. Now, I know that Sister Susan Connolly is here somewhere. I saw her walking past. Sister Susan's just written a book dealing with scapegoating. But scapegoating is the essence of camouflage in our society. You prosecute the scapegoats, so you give a notion of a reckoning, but there'll be no reckoning in the parliament. And there is no reckoning. There is no personal responsibility accepted, except in very rare instances in this country. Now, what's the way forward? Well, the way forward, in my view, is happening instinctively. There is a growing sense within the younger generation, in my view, of adopting their own personal responsibility for the environment, their own personal responsibility for the safety, particularly of women, and society is gradually coming around to fuller duties of protection for children. Now, that's a movement that, in many respects, has taken place outside the halls of Parliament, as you know. And that must be the only way we can deliver ourselves, because as Grayling, Professor Grayling says, and I hearken back to it constantly, it's an elective dictatorship now. Our duties, our obligations are enumerated for us by legislators who really are not interested in listening and trying to give the sense of sovereignty to the people. There's a famous textbook written at the turn of the Garran and Mr. Quick, lawyers, constitutional lawyers, about our Australian Constitution. In their preface, they state, the Australian Constitution is based out of the American experience on the concept that it is government by the people, for the people. The people are exercising the sovereignty. They identify the national interest and the public interest, and they adopt that themselves in their own instinctive, moral, ethical thinking, and they impart those values to our leaders. Do you think that works now? It doesn't work now. There is a total disconnect, an absolute disconnect. And I think the way forward for the common law is, as globalisation extends, it's for us to examine the great European instruments, the great human rights instruments, the European Court of Human Rights, and the way in which, in many respects, jurisprudence and ethics and thinking, philosophical thinking, has developed and passed us in our society. This used to be a great debate at table in Trinity College when I had the honour to spend a few years there fraudulently as a senior academic visitor. But those debates are live at the moment in Britain, and they should reach us soon, I hope, which is, are we going to follow the European path to personal responsibility, or are we going to continue to fragment our society? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.